You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have two guests this week, George Robb.
Happy summer, people.
And Andrea Jones-Roy.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
Guys, welcome to back to the show.
Yay!
Great to have you. Jay and Kara are on different continents. From us and each other. Kara's in Africa, Jay's in Greece right now.
The sun rarely sets on the SGU.
That's right.
Ever.
We have listeners in all seven continents because somebody told us that they listened to us in Antarctica once.
Absolutely. More than once, yes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And under the Sea of Japan in a submarine was one.
Mm-hmm. Yep, okay. The Persian Gulf. Someone was patrolling the Persian
Gulf.
Yeah,
but didn't they discover that other continent by New Zealand? I don't think anyone's on
Zealandia.
That
Zealandia. We also need somebody to listen to us on the International Space Station.
Right.
Wow, nice. When will that happen? Yes.
I'll get on that.
And eventually, Moonbase Alpha. And then
eventually, Moonbase Alpha.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Then we'll be a solar system-wide podcast.
So I sent you guys all this video, and your reaction was as predicted. So one of the running stories that we got going on the show is our wildlife encounters.
Oh, yeah.
And Kara's always cute because she thinks that we live in the woods, you know, but because there's trees surrounding my house. But the thing that's funny is it's getting harder and harder to make fun of her for that because, you know, it's like the wilderness is encroaching so much. Mm. So this was on Sunday, a few days ago, middle of the afternoon, you know, broad daylight. My dog starts barking. I'm watching Jay's dog while he's in Greece. So I have both dogs in the house. They're both inside. They both start barking at the deck, you know, through the glass sliding glass door to the deck in a way that let me know this was nothing. This was something unusual. This
was not their usual bark. Has a communication to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. My dogs do.
But it could be a raccoon. It could be something else.
Mormons. Mormons.
It could be Mormons.
Yep.
So I look over and there's a bear on my deck. Black bear. Yeah, so this is the third time that there has been a black bear encounter on my property.
You need to put up a sign to keep them out.
Yeah, no bears allowed.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll do it.
I don't know. Do they speak Italian bears? I don't know.
Black bears, I don't know. That's three times. I've been in my house for about 25 years. This is my third bear encounter in the last 4 years. So clearly an uptick.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so there was one a few years ago. It was again during the day. It knocked over the bird seed, and then it scared itself and ran away, basically.
That's then there what bird was seed
one,
is for.
Yeah, it was at nighttime. You know, again, dog barking at the deck. Thought it was probably a raccoon. Flipped on the light. There's a black bear standing on the railing of my deck trying to get at the suet, you know, the bird food.
Wow.
This time, broad daylight. It's on the deck. The dogs are going crazy. This bear was chill. Like, he was not skittish at all. You know, at some point, you guys saw in the video, he like, you know, bares his teeth at the dogs, puts his paw on the glass.
Wow.
And he wasn't going anywhere. Normally,
pulls out a cigarette.
Yeah, you could scare them away fairly easily. The other thing is, it's July. We almost always have bear sightings either in the neighborhood or somewhere in the spring when they're just coming out of hibernation and they're really jonesing for food. In the middle of the summer, you don't see them so much. Then they get active again when they're bulking up to go back into hibernation, like in the fall. But this is unusual. I've never had a bear sighting in July. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm thinking, what are we supposed to do here? You know, and the other thing I was worried about.
Take a video and send it to your family.
I did.
Yeah. Live stream it.
Yeah. The previous two times, they were gone too quickly. Well, we actually did get a little bit of a video. The first one, the second one was too fast. This one, he was there for like 5-10 minutes.
I mean, he was enormous, Steve. I was really surprised.
Like, how big do you think he was? How heavy do you think he was, Steve?
I mean that was actually the smallest of the three black bears that I slung on my property. The last one was a lot bigger. What? I think he might be
80
a
pounds?
Yearling. No. That bear's probably 200 pounds on that video.
So the third one was just right.
Forage?
So
three times
porridge.
Is the weight of your dog? Yeah, I guess.
Oh, totally.
300 pounds, sure.
I think it was Jocelyn's hands were holding the door shut.
Yeah.
Just like frantically like pulling the door shut, like, please don't.
So what did you do?
Well, I put the the board there so that she didn't have to do that. Then I closed the garage door because, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
We have garbage cans in the garage.
And bears like Teslas. We all know
that.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it's, yeah. And that the door from the garage to our where we were, like in the family room there, would not keep that bear out. You guys saw that video of a bear just blowing the door open on a house and walking in.
So how did it conclude? What happened? Like, what
all right, so it could not get the bear to go away.
Yeah.
You know, it was obviously looking for the bird seed. So we have like this half-size aluminum can on the deck for the bird seed. And we have a big, heavy rock on top of it, which is enough to keep out all animals except bears. So they're the only one strong enough to get that stone off. He had knocked it over, but the lid didn't come off. It was just sort of like, it was stuck on the top of it. So he was like nosing around that for a while. He eventually got it off, but then didn't seem that. I think once he figured out that the dogs weren't going to be able to bother him through the glass, he just ignored them from that point forward. And so I went upstairs because there's the bathroom window that overlooks the deck. I could see him from there. Took some more pictures. And then I said, all right.
I'm going to shake my fist like you won't believe.
That's right.
I yelled at him like he didn't care. Right. So then I said, all right. So then I had to find something. There was nothing at hand. I think I got a bottle of saline or something heavy. I threw it at him, hit him in the ass. Nothing. I threw something else at him. Second time. And then he just like moseyed away. Like, you know what I mean? He was just
like, whatever.
Yeah, this is boring. Then he went through the backyard, started sniffing some of the.
I'm not leaving because you asked me to.
I just choose to go. And then he went to the neighbors. We had to call the neighbor, like, there's a black bear coming your way, you know, make sure that they were inside. And then eventually he left, you know, probably went back into the woods. Yeah.
Is there someone to call? I mean, is there some kind of contingency in your town or something? Like, what
last
do you do?
Time
the Simpsons,
we called,
they had the bear patrol.
We called, you know, animal services or whatever, and they said they just noted it. They didn't do anything. They didn't send anybody. They just recorded it as a black bear sighting in Hamden, Connecticut, and that was it.
My big fear, Steve, if I were you, I'd be a little nervous, quite nervous. I mean, imagine that those two dogs were outside when he decided to show up.
I was just thinking that.
The question is, would he have like done a U-turn or went around your property? Or would he have moseyed in the property? I mean, that's scary, man.
Yeah.
Like, holy crap, he would take out a dog without much effort, I don't think, right?
A dog should be faster.
The thing is,
black
bears generally are skittish because even if they can win in a fight, it's not worth the risk. If they get a bite or something, they could get infected and die. It's just not worth the risk for them. So they go for the low-hanging fruit. Unless they're desperate. Unless they're protecting cubs or they're really desperate for food. Then they start to get more and more
Or they're
bold.
Not a big fan of the show. You know that too.
Yeah, there is that. So, but
they're more into wellness culture, but yeah.
So I looked up the laws in Connecticut, by the way. Just like, what are the laws regarding black bears in Connecticut? First of all, there's been a massive uptick in sightings and encounters. This is, you know, not just a coincidence. I've had three encounters in the last couple of years. And Connecticut's the only state in the region that doesn't allow bear hunting. The other surrounding states all have a hunting season for black bears.
Probably not enough of them to.
Let's go live in Connecticut, boo boo. It's safe.
Yeah.
We can go to the skeptics guy and get some birds with. Hey.
You know, half of the bear encounters are because of garbage, and 25% are because of bird feeders. That's my problem. And you are allowed to kill a bear if they attack you or your pets. Like, if they're attacking people or pets, you're allowed to kill them. And farmers are allowed to kill them if they attack their crops or their livestock. Other than that, you're not allowed to feed them and you're not allowed to hunt them or to kill them. But I know that, like, if bears do get too bold in their interactions, like if they do attack anything or if they come into your house, they'll put them down. Otherwise, they may move them, but they're not really doing that anymore because they don't have any place to send them. Like that.
I was going to say,
this is the big problem, is that we've encroached so much on their habitat and there really isn't that much space to move them to. Like, where are we going to move them to? There's more suburbs, you know? So they're, so they just don't do anything.
So Steve, what would be your go-to weapon in your house?
Well, I'm thinking about it. You know, like, what would I do? There's a couple of things. I think what I might want to get at hand.
Nunchucks?
I have a paintball gun. And that would hurt them, I think. You know, not going to physically
scare them.
That'll Yeah, you shoot them in the ass with a paint pellet.
Yeah,
they'll feel it.
Those probably, ass shots hurt, man.
And yeah, you'll tag it, basically. Yeah.
Although the fur would probably attenuate a bit.
But still, I think that would might be a little bit better. You know, if I had to kill it, I do have a crossbow in my house.
Wow. Please like I say, no katana. If it,
I have a katana, but I would probably prefer the ranged weapon to the katana.
Oh, yeah.
That's a more of a desperation maneuver. Wow. If I break it out of the katana. Yeah.
I'll use my bare knuckles.
So is it all habitat encroachment? Is that the whole story? Okay.
Yeah, mostly. And so there's a dramatic increase in small critters, right? And that attracts the predators. The other thing that's on a dramatic increase in Connecticut, and I'm sure just regionally, is coyotes.
Only in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Really? Oh my God, we saw a baby, like, you know, mid-sized baby adolescent outside my mom's back window for the first time. Like in my life, living in Connecticut, I have never seen a coyote. Like,
wow,
seen it. I've
their
seen
populations
boxes.
Have exploded. Oh, I saw. So about a week ago, I saw a coyote like 20 feet maybe in front of my car. Just walked across the street. It was 100% a coyote.
Yes.
And by coincidence, this morning in the bath, like I get 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting up and getting ready for my day. I'm on the bathroom, and I hear howling from outside. So I open up the window to listen to it, and there was like 5 or 6 creatures yipping and howling.
Oh yeah,
it's 100% they were coyotes.
No doubt.
So first of all, it was coming from the woods. I know all the dogs in my neighborhood. You know what I mean? There's no reason why there would be 5 or 6 dogs all together yipping and howling.
Pitch frequency.
Reason for them to start a spontaneous a cappella group or anything.
Right.
Barbershop.
I hear them at night is when I hear them.
This was 6 in the morning. And this was I'm very familiar with the sound of coyotes howling because I play Red Dead Redemption 2. And they have a pretty sophisticated sort of nature simulator in the game where they have lots of animals and they're very realistic, including the noises. Oh. So if you play that game, you totally know what coyotes sound like.
Oh, so and it's this a was nature lesson.
This is 100% coyotes.
Wow.
So there's a whole group of them just howling in the woods this morning.
Oh boy!
So Kara's been right this whole time. You are just in the wilderness, but really we've taken over wilderness.
Yeah, I'm surrounded on two sides by woods, and they're pretty deep. You know, but if you keep going, you get to another road. Though I mean, there's not that big.
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of wilderness. I looked it up too. Coyote populations are exploding everywhere. Basically, they're just really, really well adapted to human civilization. They do well in the cities and the suburbs and the rural areas.
Which means you gotta watch your pets, watch your dogs, watch your cats, watch your
A news item that I actually considered for this week had to do with a wolf that was either spotted or hunted somewhere that it wasn't normally expected to be found, and it was a mix of like, oh wow, this is kind of exciting because of, you know, population dynamics and they can survive here. But then it was also like, oh, maybe this is very concerning, depending on your point of view.
Well, that's part of the reason for the explosion in coyotes is because we killed a lot of the wolves.
Right.
And they're just filling the space. I don't mind the coyotes because, you know, they pretty much keep to themselves. They eat a lot, mostly rodents, you know. Yeah. They did an analysis of coyote scat, and it was like, 98% of their food is basically animals. Mm-hmm. And
can they come to New York City? And that might be the rat czar solution.
Yeah. No, they are already. I remember there was a few years ago we read there was a study that estimated there were 70,000 coyotes in Chicago.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember that science or fiction or something we talked about on the show. I was like, what?
Fiction.
So they're doing. The other thing we talked about recently was that the mountain lions are moving east. In 10 years, we may have them to deal with too.
Wow.
Well, then they'll come up against the bears, and maybe that will.
And meanwhile, we'll be all underwater anyway. So it's the piranhas.
It'll be dolphins and sharks.
Yeah. Man.
I know. So this encounter. The other two I thought were just quirks. With this encounter, because, you know, the fact is that bear was not skittish. He was perfectly comfortable facing off against those dogs.
Yeah.
You know, they were not. He was not scared away by people. You know what I mean?
This wasn't his first rodeo.
That's not good. He's acclimated to people's homes.
I mean,
that's
him clawing at the door was chilling.
Yeah. So now I'm like, all right, how do I have to change my behavior now? Because like we generally leave our garage door open because that's where we let the dog in and out.
Right.
And that's where we also have our garbage. Maybe we can't do that anymore.
Ooh, yeah.
Did they need to like capture him and like, you know, tie him to the chair and hold his eyes open and with the drops and the classical yeah, music right. in the background? Is that how we got to reacclimate him to the nature? I don't know.
Yeah. Got to reprogram him. Now, for those bears, they either move them or put them down when they get too comfortable with people.
You have to name him something so you can just refer to him. You need some kind of a name.
Barney.
Barney's name's taken. It's a dinosaur.
Yeah. Right. Barney is for dinosaurs. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll keep our listeners updated if you have any more interesting wildlife
encounters.
Yep. In Pennsylvania, George, what kind of wildlife encounters do you have?
We have – in Bethlehem, we have foxes that are actually really cool. There's a big cemetery that's here, and there's a couple foxes that live there they're just like – classy and cool. Mm-hmm. There's something about it. So you see a fox in the distance, kind of looks over at you. You look over at the fox. You both acknowledge each other. You're just like, yeah, this is kind of cool. And they go about their business. We have a lot of deer. Mm-hmm. You know, I've hit, I think since, you know, in my couple of decades living here, I think I've hit three deer.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I'm at three. Yep.
You're at three. Yeah. And
sadly, like damaged, killed, injured.
No, one was looking at me funny, and I was just like, look, yeah. man, yeah. just, you know,
no,
I'm just trying to have a good time. I'm just in a restaurant. Just leave me alone. No, car. One was on a highway, ran out into me. Another one was also on like a little side road, and just they just bolted out and hit the side of my car. And, you know, they're just massive, just massive.
Oh, really?
And they can take a hit, too.
Kill people. Yeah. Kill themselves.
Yeah, yeah, we got raccoons and stuff like that. But, yeah, nothing. No bears, thankfully. Thankfully, no bears yet. But, you know, just give it time.
Yeah.
Just give it time.
Yeah, we got all that. We had one sighting of a Fisher cat. You guys ever encounter one of those?
A Fisher cat?
Oh, no.
I've heard of a Fisher king.
I've heard of them.
Cat. Yeah.
They're tough, man.
They're tough, yeah. You recognize it mainly by its call. It has a very – if you ever watch a
– Fish on.
A UK TV show, right? And their canned soundtrack for nighttime is different than in the United States. Like, when it's nighttime on a TV show in the US, what do you have? You have crickets and frogs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the UK, I noticed like they have Fisher cats screeching in the background. That's their nighttime –
Fisher cats and teacups. That's
background noise. Because it's like this, it's like a child screaming kind of noise.
Oh, great.
Huh. Wow.
Is anyone getting to sleep in that country?
Wow. Yeah.
How do they, I guess screaming. Maybe they find crickets absurdly distracting, whereas I let them, they blend in. Yeah.
So does it sound kind of like this?
I mean, I should insert this noise at this point in the show, so probably I'll do that. Again, if you play Red Dead Redemption, it's every time it's nighttime, screeching in the background, like that's a Fisher cat.
You get a zoology degree at the end of that game.
You could.
Did you hear the story that the USPGA, the golf people that were broadcasting golf, were broadcasting bird sounds over footage, but it wasn't the local birds, and people noticed and complained, where they were saying, like, you're using the wrong birds, like these birds wouldn't be in Florida. So they had to basically, there's the wrong soundtrack during this big golf tournament.
My gosh.
They had to get the right birds into it. I thought that was great.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
You can't get away with anything.
But of course, people would notice that.
I read today about an app. It was like, are you sick of social media? And I said, yes. And they said, well, download this other app where basically it's kind of like a Shazam for nature where you put it in your yard and it tells you like what kind of birds are doing the bird calls or if it's a squirrel or if it's a whatever.
Yeah. Identifying. Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, I think I need that.
That's pretty neat.
What I need.
That's
cool. It would just be rats. Can I talk about rats some more? But
sure.
It would just be rats.
All right, Evan, you're going to do a dumbest thing of the week.
Yep. Dumbest thing of the week. And hey, look, it's we have two special guests with us this week.
Are we it?
Are we the dumbest things?
Oh, man. Andrea, let's get out of here.
And,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
So unclassed.
Where are you
sit down. Sit down. Get back. Steve, I don't think they've heard the official song for this segment, The Dumbest Thing of the Week.
Oh, boy.
And George being the musician, I think he can wholly appreciate this. So here I go. It's the dumbest thing of the week. It's the dumbest thing of I speak. In a world full of fools, this story rules. The dumbest thing of the week. Thank you.
Very nice.
Oh, bravo. Thank you. Thank you.
Bravo.
I'm going to wake up in the middle of that night with that in my head and not remember where I got it.
I'll remind you. Don't worry. All right.
Okay. All right.
Avi Loeb, astrophysicist.
Oh, not again.
Here we go. That's all I had to say. Two words in and take it away, Bob. Astrophysicist and professor of science at Harvard University. He must be tenured because I don't know how someone like Professor Loeb keeps a position at Harvard.
Academic freedom. That's
yeah, right. Well, he and the late John Mack, they met the same criteria, whatever it is, but I don't want to digress too far.
He was also on Steve's porch yesterday. It was really weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
but the bear made more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Avi Loeb, yeah, he of the belief that back in 2017, when the space object name Oumuamua was detected in our solar system, that this was possibly an alien space probe with a propulsion system disguising itself as a comet. In fact, he wrote a book about this called Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth, arguing that Oumuamua had been nothing less than humanity's first contact with an artifact of extraterrestrial intelligence. There you go. Now, it wasn't simply, you know, a object that was outgassing hydrogen as the comet warmed up by the sunlight and propelled it along sort of at an unusual sort of distance and speed. But other than that, yeah, that's what he believes. Now, Professor Loeb just recently claimed that tiny sphericals or spherules, am I pronouncing that right? Spherules?
Yeah, spherules or spheres.
Spherules, spheres. Yeah, I'll just call them spheres. He and his team, they collected them from the floor of the Pacific Ocean. And they are mysterious alloys. They may be evidence of an interstellar object and even possibly more proof of the existence of an extraterrestrial civilization. Yep.
Ah.
Yeah. I learned about this, and I wound up going to one of Kara's favorite go-to sites for science called The Conversation. And here's what they say. Loeb is linking his finding with the passage of a fireball back in January of 2014. This meteor was observed by sensors of the U.S. Department of Defense that tracks all objects entering the Earth's atmosphere. It was recorded as traveling faster than most meteors. And eventually broke up over the South Pacific Ocean near Papua New Guinea. All right. So, and ever since his provocative thoughts on Oumuamua, Professor Loeb and his team of researchers, they've been pursuing leads to find more interstellar debris floating around our solar system. And as part of that pursuit, they've been looking through data at the Center for Near Earth Object Studies, CNEOS. Going through their database, looking for objects with unusual orbital characteristics. And a candidate was this particular meteor from January of 2014, due to the object's higher than normal velocity, right? Suggesting perhaps that this object originated from outside our solar system. Interstellar, as they say. So, they traveled to the coordinates where the meteor would have hit the ocean. They dredged the ocean floor with a powerful magnet sled, which picked up dozens of spherical objects. Little tiny spheres, molten droplets, about half a millimeter in diameter. And he wrote a blog post about it. We have discovered spherules from the path of the first recognized interstellar meteor, which they're designating IM1. Fine. Here's what they say. They used X-ray fluorescence analyzers to get its composition. They found a composition of mostly iron with some magnesium and titanium, but no nickel. This composition is anomalous compared to human-made alloys, known asteroids, and familiar astrophysical sources. Our preliminary analysis implies that the composition of mostly iron with a tenth of that in magnesium and some titanium does not resemble known human-made alloys or familiar asteroids. The fundamental question is obvious. Was this the first recognized interstellar object from 2014 manufactured by a technological civilization? Here we go again.
Wow, just leaping to that. Leap.
Oh my gosh, like, this guy has a penchant for doing this, clearly.
Okay.
That's not his thing.
Yeah.
So the thing is, other than that last giant leap into speculation,
land, I was sort of with it. Yeah.
Yeah, the science is fine. So they basically said, we're going to try to see if we can identify from historical NASA records of incoming meteors anything that had characteristics that might mean that it's interstellar. So that was the first one, the 2014 meteor, because it was traveling too fast to have been an object from within the solar system because its velocity is so high that it would have. It's like escape velocity for the sun, you know? So sure, that's a pretty good argument that meteor was probably an interstellar object. Then they went and they looked at the calculated path of the meteor.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they dredged up the floor with their magnet, right, to see if they could find anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they did three other control areas. Again, I don't know where exactly they were. And they had fewer of those spherules. Not none, just fewer. But fine, okay. So even if I buy that at all, good job. You identified a probable interstellar meteor. You found what may be some remnants of it. You know, because if you know, as the meteor is burning up, you know, the spherules are a sign that something was basically liquefied and then rained back down to Earth. Because when it's in free fall, it becomes a sphere and then it solidifies and there you go. And that's like a standard kind of evidence for comet impacts and meteor impacts and stuff like that. So fine, that's all good evidence.
Ergo, Superman is real.
Right. but therefore.
Keep in mind, these little, you know, these little spheres are mostly iron.
Which we are familiar with, as I recall.
Right. Yeah. So fine. It's
exotic
not the same ratio as meteors that we find in our solar system. Good. You've already. I said it's an extra. It's extra stellar. You know, it's outside. It's
perhaps
an interstellar object. Mm-hmm. But what are you telling me, that the aliens made their spaceship out of iron?
That would be
right.
That's how advanced they are.
That's what they're talking about. Yeah. And there's plenty of other interstellar sources of iron,
right,
that would also fit all of those characters that he's talking about, that isn't man-made and isn't a meteor from our solar system. One of the coolest is that when large stars, the largest stars will fuse elements down to iron at their core, and then they'll go supernova. And they could basically, the iron core explodes and sends these little fragments of iron throughout the universe. It could be one of those fragments, you know. It would be interstellar. It would be mostly iron with just trace elements otherwise. So that's a possibility. That's cool. So the astronomy here is interesting and cool, but he spoils it by making this unfounded leap to it's aliens, you know. And in interviews, I don't know how many interviews you saw with him, Evan, but he doesn't come right out and say it. He's like, well, we're investigating that. And
right.
But just listing it as a possibility invokes it as a possibility.
Of course.
Yeah.
And not only that, but the interviewer, the only thing they wanted to talk about was aliens. That was it. That was the whole interview.
Of course.
So you're telling me this could be aliens?
He got his hits. He got his clicks.
Yeah. Completely irresponsible.
Yep. So here, a couple other things, Steve, to add to that skepticism. Peter Brown, meteorite specialist at University of Western Ontario, says, basically, it's really hard to know whether he actually picked up, first of all, this debris actually came from that particular comet. He said it essentially would be impossible to say that these particular spheres come from this particular event. So that hasn't even really been proven. This thing has not been tested for age, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how old are these things? You know, did he rule out all the terrestrial pollutants? And here's something else he said that was interesting. He said that particularly at higher speeds, the U.S. government sensors tend to overestimate the speeds at which they measure these things coming into our atmosphere. So we're not even, I suppose, really 100% sure that this was ever something that did come in at a higher than usual rate. So all those things still need to be investigated. And Brown said, I don't see any evidence that would necessarily bring you into such an extreme hypothesis that this would have anything to do with either alien technology or even necessarily something that's interstellar.
I mean, it sounds as useful as saying, well, it was aliens that caused the submersible to implode too. You're like, I guess, I don't know. Like, it could have been aliens who did anything. Like, it just doesn't seem any more reasonable to include here than any other claim of anything that's ever happened.
At best, it's an argument from ignorance. But
Evan,
you're right. Like, there's four links in this chain, right? You know, and let's focus on the first three. I mean, those are kind of semi-plausible, you know, that this was interstellar, that it was not a standard meteorite, you know, that, you know what I mean? All these things, that the things that he found are actually from something, are from a meteor and from an interstellar meteor. But that last step is like, wait a minute, whoa, let's focus on the first three, you know, the ones that are actually plausible, you know?
Yeah, these are Michio Kaku level sound bites just to get attention.
Yeah.
It's, it's annoying as hell.
Yeah, and in a way trying to, I think, do perhaps some reputation rebuilding from his, from, you know, his prior incidents, which, you know, have certainly, there's been a lot of ridicule of him since he came out back in 2017.
Oh, yeah, he's had
What is that about? What is first off, I think this is more likely Iron Age time travelers, but I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
Well,
no, but what is it about these you know, on some level qualified experts who then just veer off? Is it this sort of idea of being blinded by the clicks, being blinded by book deals, by television appearances?
I think that's a layer. That's part of it. I think it's also – the other part is that he's not
critical thinker. They're not, critical thinkers.
You could be a scientist without being a great critical thinker. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's it's so weird, man.
Yeah, so they commit some basic logical errors.
Right.
Like argument from ignorance, for example, and they don't realize it. And then, you know, his project that he's working now is like the Galileo project. Like,
right.
Really? Are you that tone deaf? That you are going to label your project with the Galileo fallacy.
Like it.
I mean, like
the Einstein
collective,
right?
Yeah, to the entire.
Oh my God, that's why he named it Galileo.
Yeah,
yeah, because he's going to be. Yeah, he's the pioneer.
He's taking the defensive thing of we shouldn't be stigmatizing exploratory science, and you shouldn't, you know, just because we're looking for something new doesn't mean you should, you know, be ridiculing it. No, we're ridiculing you because of your horrible logic. Because you're not being a critical thinker.
It's the true Scotsman project.
It's crankish.
Yeah, right?
It definitely is. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Oh, just remind me what he's a professor of?
No, he's an astrophysicist.
He is.
Yeah. Okay. I was like, maybe
an accomplished one.
No, he's a legit astronomer. It's just that he decided that he's going to make this his thing. And then
He went to the dark side.
Then you write a book and you get the press and you get the interviews. And otherwise, nobody would care about his career at all. And so that... You can't underestimate the...
Well, that's what brings me back to the freedom of speech note that someone said, which is like, yeah, I guess he can say these things, but, you know, freedom of speech shouldn't protect scientists pretending to do science, right? Like, we have freedom of speech around things that are maybe social issues and they're debated and we argue about that, but I rarely see it, you know. We retract scientific articles if there are errors, right? Is it because he's not publishing these things in scientific outlets that they can't get him on that?
No, he is, but no, it's not freedom of speech. It's academic freedom is what gets cited. Yeah, so the same thing with John Mack, which Evan mentioned, who was a Harvard psychiatrist who came to believe that his patients were actually abducted by aliens.
Oh, my God.
Like, he literally fell for his own patients' delusions. Like, rule number one for psychiatry is you don't believe your own patients' delusions. And, you know, his argumentation was horrible. His methods became terrible. He just, you know, became involved in just verifying his beliefs rather than trying to disprove them.
This smacks of as well?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In a way.
But that's just it. Doesn't academic freedom prevent you from, like, your department could be able to step in and say, well, it's not actually science that you're doing anymore. But I guess if you have tenure, you can't even do that.
I mean, there's a very high threshold for doing something because somebody's on the fringe. You know, unless you're sleeping with your students, you're pretty much okay.
I mean, we've had people in political science get in trouble for falsifying data, and that is grounds for maybe... These were younger scholars who ended up getting their job offers rescinded. So they weren't tenured and there wasn't that. But, you know, people do get fired for like falsifying results
For
like
fraud.
You said, sleeping with students. But, yeah.
Lowe's but I guess this isn't a case of fraud, though. I don't think he's doctoring any of his data. He's just drawing these conclusions based on
that aren't fair
specious arguments.
Critical. Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and you know, that's not unreasonable, you know, having a wide berth for academic freedom. You know what I mean?
That's true.
You're going to have to allow some cranks in there in order to make sure that people who have legit but out there ideas, you know, have the freedom to pursue that.
Right.
But yeah, but in the modern media environment that we're in, the downside is just magnified significantly. Like the only thing the media wanted to talk about was this. So you're saying this could be aliens, right? You know, that was it. That was
And then it's a badge of honor too. If someone like that does get, like, let's say, kicked out of a university, then they often flip it around and will be like, "Look,
what are they trying to hide?
What are they trying to hide? I had these great ideas and they threw me out. So buy my book." Yeah, it's like you can't.
I mean,
win.
You see it with anti-vaxxer sorts of campaigns and other things too. Like, there are serious health consequences. But you're right; they just form another rebellion university So
right, right,
yeah, exactly. All right,
go RU. Yeah, all right.
Dumbest thing of the week. Thank you, Avery Lewis.
Let's talk about some actual science.
So hold on. So there aren't aliens? That's my headline.
There's your takeaway.
No, the takeaway is aliens are flying in iron spaceships. That's right.
Like,
and they abducted Jay and Kara. So that's where we're
going. And sent a bear.
Sent a bear.
Yeah, it was an iron bear. Very realistic.
Okay, so the FDA has recently approved Leqembi as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
What? Really?
Yes. And this is kind of a big deal. It really is. But let me give you back up a little bit. So first of all, the FDA gave a kind of a preliminary approval, what's called accelerated approval, to this drug in January of this year, based upon their new, relatively new, like a few years old, accelerated approval program, right? And so which they created this pathway, this accelerated approval pathway. Here's a quote from the FDA. To approve drugs for serious conditions where there is an unmet medical need based on clinical data demonstrating the drug's effect on a surrogate endpoint that is reasonably likely to predict a clinical benefit to patients. So that was a departure from historic FDA procedures. So normally, in order to get the drug approved for a disease, you have to prove that it actually treats the disease, right? That there's improvement in a clinical outcome, in you know, reasonably in excess of any risk. But they said, well, all right, so we're going to, for the first time, approve drugs not without proof that they actually work, but based entirely on a surrogate endpoint, or you can also say a biomarker, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, this, so protein is going up or down or whatever, and that might indicate, you know, a benefit to the disease. So we'll use that to approve the drug, but only accelerated approval, not full approval, right? And mm-hmm. and they'll make it contingent on eventually getting clinical evidence showing that it works, that it actually works. So 2 years ago, the FDA approved Aduhelm, which is another Alzheimer's drug, also based on this pathway with only evidence that it reduces a biomarker without clinical evidence. And that drug is still being studied to see if it actually works clinically. This drug got the accelerated approval in January, but now they just approved it for like a traditional approval based upon a recent study showing that it reduces the progression of Alzheimer's by 20%.
Wow. 20%.
Yeah.
What was the biomarker?
So, well, it's amyloid protein and the buildup of amyloid plaques. So Leqembi is a monoclonal antibody. There's been a slew of monoclonal antibodies coming out in the last decade. This really is almost a revolution in medicine that's happening. These are, you know, antibodies, they're proteins, and just the technology of making, like commercially making these monoclonal antibodies that are humanized, you know, so that they're safer and they're not rejected, and they could target them against a protein. So if you have a clinical target, give it a receptor or something somewhere that you could say, if we block that, it'll help this disease. You could, instead of making a drug to do it, you could make a monoclonal antibody to do it. But these are proteins, so you can't eat them. So there's no pill. You either have to get an injection or an IV infusion. So this treatment, the Leqembi, which is lecanemab. So all the monoclonal antibodies end in mab. That's how you know.
Ah, clever.
So lecanemab.
I get it. Yeah.
Is every 2 weeks you get an IV infusion. That's the treatment. So just forever, you get an IV infusion every 2 weeks. The estimate is that it will cost per patient per year $26,500.
Not really affordable. Yeah.
It's a lot. Not, you know, at Aduhelm, they estimated it at like $55,000.
Whoa.
So this is less expensive than
that. It's a bargain,
man.
Yeah, okay.
Sweet. Yeah, monoclonal antibodies, you know, the ones that I'm familiar with, they, like, you know, the low end is like $6,000-$7,000 a year, but it goes up from there. So anyway, so yeah, it would be very, very expensive. They only studied it in early onset Alzheimer's, so not advanced. That, you know, probably because it would have the best chance of working. And, it, you know, the clinical data looks good. And it, you know, the primary endpoint was robustly statistically significant. It's a clinically significant benefit. All the secondary measures were better. There's really no red flags in terms of, does this work? Yeah, it seems like it does work. And it also showed that it decreased, you know, the amyloid, you know, that it's targeting as well. There are some significant side effects. It can cause some brain swelling and brain bleeding. Two things you want to know. Because, you know, it's an inflammatory attack against proteins in your brain. You know what I mean? So inflammation is kind of part of the package here. So it caused some kind of reaction in 26% of patients, but it caused the edema in 12.6%. So that's, you know, 12.6% is a significant percentage.
Well, how significant is the edema, though?
Yeah, right. So yeah. Most of those patients were asymptomatic from the swelling and just had like micro hemorrhages. But some of them could be significant. They can get, you can get headaches and dizziness from it. And it can actually, if the bleed is significant, it can be even life-threatening. So it can be a significant side effect. I do think, though, that like if you are facing Alzheimer's disease, you probably would take this risk. You know, you would think, yeah, it's not perfect, but acceptable. You know, obviously, this is the first drug that actually alters the disease in Alzheimer's, right? The first, what we would call disease-modifying treatment. All previous treatments were just symptomatic. You know, they might improve your memory while you're on the medication, but they're not altering the course of the disease. Mm. This is the first one that's actually slowing down progression of the disease. That is significant, hugely significant. Now, within the community, it's huge news because it's really the first clinical confirmation we've received that all this stuff we think about what's happening in Alzheimer's disease
is correct,
right?
Oh, okay, so that's a good indicator that you're on the right path.
Yeah, because for the last 50 years, you know, we've been studying Alzheimer's, you know, collectively, the royal we, been studying Alzheimer's, and we're discovering all this stuff, all these biomarkers, all this stuff that's happening in the brain and in brain cells of Alzheimer's patients. And we don't know if any of it is actually the cause of the disease or the result of the disease. Right. You know what I mean? Is this something that just happens because of Alzheimer's, or is this driving Alzheimer's? Is this causing it? And so until you close that loop and you say, if we interfere with this process, people actually either they get better or it slows down progression, you just don't know for sure that you're dealing with an actual cause. So this is really the first clinical confirmation the beta amyloid hypothesis is really clinically like part of, probably not the whole thing, but part of the cause of Alzheimer's. So that's huge.
So how long before the misinformed fringe advocates start complaining about this as being a big ploy?
Because it's $26,000
a year. Big pharma. What, a year maybe?
Yeah, who knows? I'm sure there's going to be some kind of
pushback
theory about it.
Yeah.
It does bode well for the other drug, the Aduhelm, because it's a similar mechanism. So if this works, hopefully the other one will work as well. I hope that this is just sort of the first drug. That this isn't, you know, this isn't the end of this research process. This is just, okay, oh, we're on the right track. Great.
Like this is doing something.
Yeah, let's keep going in this direction.
Because you don't have to cure it. All you got to do is delay it enough where it's like it'll just never happen because you're not going to live to be 120 to really see it, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And not that much because, again, most people get it late in life.
Right.
And, you know, most people survive 10, 11 years after diagnosis. So if you think of, like, for somebody who gets diagnosed at 70, you know, if you slow it down maybe by 50% or 60%, that might be enough. We want to get to the point where you die with Alzheimer's, but not of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know?
That's going to be huge for quality of life.
Yeah, and it's
of
slowing
the families,
down.
Of everyone. Yeah.
It's not like you're just surviving longer, but horribly demented. The hope is that you have
thank goodness for that.
Retaining
yourself.
Yeah, some of yourself and your independence and your functionality. Yeah.
And you only forget the people you want to forget.
Yeah.
I'm already doing that just as a voluntary sort of thing. Yeah. Steve, what do you think is the next horizon of improvements? Is it more like more of this that, you know, do it better? Or is it like now that we know this, we can explore these other
possible mechanisms? Good question.
Are we at the limit of like the amyloid approach to treating Alzheimer's? So we'll see. You know, we'll see how well Aduhelm works. We'll see if there's
in
the pipeline. No, but the other thing is, you know,
can't you just jump to some conclusion about iron spheres or something?
There are other things going on. If we, and again, Alzheimer's disease is probably not one disease. It's probably different people have different diseases. Here's another
syndrome?
Thing. Is that, no, it's not a syndrome. It is a disease, but there's different subtypes. So for example, and they did look at this in this study, there is a genetic variation, the ApoE protein, right, which is involved with the beta amyloid. So if you have one version of that protein, you have a higher risk of Alzheimer's than if you have another version, right? And you have, everyone has two copies of everything, right? Because we have, you know, a pair of chromosomes. So if you have two bad copies, your risk of Alzheimer's is 10 times the baseline. Mm. If you have one bad and one good, it's 4 times. And if you have two good, then it's at baseline, right? Mm. The people who had two copies of the bad gene did not respond to treatment.
Ouch.
And the people who had one copy responded, but not as well. And the people who had no copies responded the best. So that's interesting, too. Mm.
Yeah.
It's also like it's a double whammy. It's like, yeah, you have a high risk of getting Alzheimer's and you won't respond to treatment. So, but what does that mean about them? Like they have something else. It's like a different, there's a different, slightly different biochemical process going on.
Oof. And therefore, the intervention obviously has to be different.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, again, there's tau protein is another one that, you know, could be a target. There's other things that are happening that are, you know, either breakdown products that are building up, you know, plaque formation, fibrillary tangles, there's, you know, cell death, all this stuff happening. The hope is we'll have end up with a cocktail of two or three treatments, you know, that added together. Like if they each whack it back by 20%, we end up with that 50-60% decrease. And then, you know, it becomes, it's not like destiny. It's just, yeah, you have it. Well, we could manage it. It's a manageable chronic illness. But of course, the big concern and this, you know, will vary country by country is, okay, there's 6 million people with Alzheimer's in the United States.
And that's going up.
Yeah, even if it's just like, all right, let's just give it to like 1 million of those 6.7 or whatever million is, that's $26.5 billion a year just for the drug, not including other associated costs. For some countries, that's going to be unsustainable. And then you got to, and we're just, are we just inventing drugs that we're not going to be able to afford to give to people? It's the other thing.
Right. Or only the rich people.
Yeah. All kinds of questions come along.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's great, but it's not.
It's not simple. A panacea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's complicated.
The most encouraging part really is, Steve, what you said about the confirmation.
Yeah. Totally.
The thinking is along the right track. Like to me, that seems like, you know, there's very serious problems with allocating the drug and affording the drug and who it helps and all of that. But that's very exciting just as like a research breakthrough that we're like, we're not casting about completely in the dark.
Absolutely.
Decades to get
there. It also kind of justifies the FDA advanced approval pathway, which I think is kind of a 50-50 on that. You know, I could see the reason for it, but it, you know, the predictability of biomarkers is not great. I guess it depends on how it gets used. You know,
are there other types of illnesses that you think would be good for biomarker viability?
Well, they basically said we're going to do this for neurodegenerative diseases, and they've already done one for ALS too. That's the other one.
Okay,
I was going to say, Steve, I'm itching to ask you about ALS, but I don't want to derail the conversation just as far as treatment on that because it seems like another one of these black box mystery sets of diseases.
Same things. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of biomarkers. We've already had a drug that slows it down by about 10-20%. You know, that was approved maybe 15 years ago. You know, there's lots of things in the pipeline. Even some recent drugs.
Monoclonal antibodies?
Well, now they're starting to turn monoclonal antibodies towards ALS as well. So it's kind of in the same boat as Alzheimer's. There's some encouraging treatments, but it's still a long way. No cure. You know, it's just, you could survive for a few more months if you take this, from the beginning.
Well, who knows? When they finally do come out with a monoclonal treatment for ALS, maybe it will be dramatic.
Yeah, we'll see. But again, part of the ALS has the same problem. It's like we have so many targets, we don't know which is the right one to really be targeting. All right, let's move on. George.
Yeah.
Finally, have we solved this deep, deep mystery about how Jeffrey Epstein died?
It looks like we have. You know, this story reminds me of what I call the novella postulate, which is, you know, when deciding between conspiracy and incompetence, always lean towards incompetence.
Yeah, it's like computer problems and user error. I mean,
exactly. Unplug it and then replug it in, basically. Yeah. So Jeffrey Epstein, as we all know, was suspected of sex trafficking. He was arrested. He ran a sex trafficking ring with young women. He had lots of very rich, wealthy, and famous people that would visit his island and that he worked with and stuff like that. He was jailed in July of 2019. And while he was awaiting trial, he was in the New York Metropolitan Correctional Center, or MCC. About a month after he was in jail, he killed himself. He was supposed to be under close watch. And so there was a lot of questions, whether it was a suicide or not. Tons of conspiracies started being floated about because of, you know, his high profile acquaintances, many of whom were rich or prominent or famous or whatever. And obviously famous people don't kill themselves ever. So the far right started pushing a whole, you know, murder plot and things like that. Subsequently, the U.S. Justice Department decided, the Inspector General from the U.S. Justice Department decided to investigate whether or not Jeffrey Epstein's suicide was legit. And surprise, surprise. So it does turn out that he died by suicide. Suicide was what transpired. However, the report that was given by the Justice Department was pretty aggressive in its criticism of the MCC, the Metropolitan Correction Center, and the Bureau of Prisons. So, the inspector basically said that, negligence, misconduct, and really poor staff performance all contributed to Epstein killing himself. They found serious staffing issues, for one. There was one guard there that worked for 24 hours straight because there weren't enough people to cover shifts. Security cameras weren't working. They didn't work. You know, there was one of the conspiracies was that the camera was turned off. So that, you know, they couldn't see what Epstein was doing. And it wasn't that the camera was turned off. It just was busted and it was never busted. Fixed.
Oh,
you know?
Half of these cameras are busted.
They're busted. Remarkable. And also, because of his status, Epstein got special treatment. So they found pictures of his cell where he had extra clothes and stuff on his bed and on his floor. And he wasn't supposed to have an extra bed sheet or extra clothes. The exact thing that he used to hang himself.
Oh.
Okay. Mm. There was also, he was supposed to be housed with a cellmate, which he wasn't. He was earlier on housed with a cellmate, and the cellmate warned everybody, hey, he's talking about suicide. That was kind of ignored.
Oh my God.
You know, two officers were supposed to check on Epstein every 30 minutes, throughout the night, and they didn't check once. During the entire night, they didn't because they were either distracted or they just weren't doing their job or whatever. On top of that, guards falsified records and they lied to investigators to cover their asses that they weren't doing their job correctly. So, you know, staffing, broken cameras, all of this stuff is horrible. So much so that prison has now been shut down. So
really,
yeah, or at least that section of it. So also the city's medical examiner's office ruled that the injuries that Epstein had were consistent with hanging as opposed to consistent with being strangled or being having some external force on him. So it's not the first time that the significant job performance and management failure on part of the BOP personnel has been found. There's been consistent reports of like widespread disregard for their own policies, like checking on prisoners, being aware of suicide watch, all those kinds of things. So this rather in-depth report says, no, there was no conspiracy. The guy just probably knew what his fate was going to be and died by suicide. So I'm reminded of the Petraeus scandal, that was the first thing that popped in my head. If you're unaware, you know, this was when the director of the CIA, David Petraeus, had an affair with his biographer, Paula Broadwell, and it was found out. So like, you know, the head of the CIA couldn't hide his affair, you know, so people talk about, oh yeah, these vast, vast conspiracies involving dozens or hundreds of people. The guy who was running the CIA couldn't basically hide the fact that he couldn't keep it in his pants. So like he was the director he ended up resigning. He was a retired four-star general and he ran the CIA. And while he was running the CIA, he had a biographer that was writing a thing. And then Paula Broadwell, they ended up having an affair. And so then, the FBI found out and it triggered his resignation, which is the go-to story for any kind of conspiracy I always talk about. So that's what this reminded me of. So,
yeah, I like to say they couldn't hide a blowjob in the Oval Office.
Right. Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. So Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide.
But people just don't find that answer satisfying.
Of course not.
And
no, because of the horrific nature of his crimes. And
yeah, I think, well, I think it's, there's a few things going on here just in terms of like critical thinking, skeptical lessons. So there's something called hyperactive agency detection, right? Where essentially we like to think that when things happen, especially big things, they were deliberate. Like somebody engineered it to happen, right? That's our go-to sort of gut reaction. Something big happens. Who made that happen? It wasn't an accident. Shit just doesn't happen.
That was meticulously planned.
It was engineered, right? That was a deliberate outcome. And then the next question is, well, who benefits? Qui bono, right? Who would have benefited from that? They must have engineered it.
Right.
So that's sort of just where our minds go, because that narrative is just satisfying.
It's comforting,
yeah.
Well, we hate the idea of random chaos.
Yeah.
Like we hate this idea that, oh, you know, a president can be killed by a random weirdo.
Yeah.
Like history can take a sharp right turn because of one lunatic. Like that doesn't sit very well with this idea of how civilization is supposed to work.
Yeah.
So it has to be a massive thing.
People don't like the idea of not having control.
Yep.
So this puts control,
even evil
in the
control,
hands of somebody.
Right.
Just not just random forces, which is kind of
and
scary.
A hyper kind of control that managed to pull something off without revealing its secrets. Yeah,
beyond human capability. Actually,
and they're just distracting us with these affairs and blowjobs. That's what's going on.
We want to see. We want to see Epstein on trial. We want to see that. We want to watch that movie. We want to see all the witnesses come out. We want to hear all these stories. So it's yes, he's not around anymore. But that's an unsatisfying kind of narrative because we caught the guy. We caught the guy, and now there gets to be a trial, and oh, now he's gone.
Yeah, but he could have implicated the other people who also were likely part of the criminal enterprise that was going on here.
Well, sure, that's part of the appeal.
That opportunity is largely gone now because of this. So that it also, and again,
it feeds into it.
Right.
But it also doesn't make it illegitimate in a way, right? It's not an invalid point.
It's a good way to generate a hypothesis, right? So if you're doing an investigation, like, well, who had the motivation to pull off the crime? That's fine. It doesn't prove they're guilty.
No, that's
the leap of logic.
You're right.
Yeah, it's just okay. That's a person of interest, but you can't arrest them and put them on trial because you have that one suspicion that they may have benefited from the outcome. So that's the problem. It's like there are things that are good for generating hypotheses or guiding an investigation. That doesn't mean it's good enough to conclude that that's what actually happened. But I think what a lot of you are touching on is something else that I think is important to realize. And I do think there also is this bias that we have just collectively, and some obviously more than others, that the world is being run by mature, competent adults.
Oh, yeah. Competency.
And when we know that the world is being run by petty, mediocre people, because we are generally petty, mediocre people, like just human beings.
I know I am.
I got to write this down. Yeah, this is good.
No, I mean, there are exceptional people who are like very serious and mature, some people who are brilliant, and it's great when that kind of person gets into a position that they should be in. But I think that's more the exception than the rule.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we go about, and I think it's partly because of movies. You know, because, right?
Mostly because of that. It's like that's always the big spy network that's so efficient and everyone's doing their job so brilliantly and they've got this major overarching plan. But it's think of every organization you've ever been in.
Yeah.
There's always douchebags in it that just don't know what the hell they're doing. And it feels like, how are we even doing this? How is this even working?
I mean, most CIA meetings are probably dreadfully boring and filled with touch points and circle backs, just
who
like everything.
We've been
all
in those donuts again.
I think that comedies are probably a lot closer to the truth than dramas.
Oh, yeah.
In that way, you think about like MASH or something. That's probably, and in fact, I remember like a police officer once said to me, the most accurate show on television about policing is Barney Miller, which is a comedy. Day to day, most people are goofballs, right? That's just the human condition. And You know what I mean? We're not these like ultra serious, you know, things.
Right.
That requires like a culture of professionalism that has to really be imposed.
I know.
And it's not the default. It doesn't happen automatically.
Did you ever see the Informant? That's a movie, a Matt Damon film.
Matt Damon, yeah.
Where he plays a guy that was dealt with the lysine price fixing. It sounds like a very dry, boring kind of thing, but it's a hilarious film. It's a Steven Soderbergh film. It's based on a true story, and it just shows at every level sort of incompetence that's dealing with the big industries and police and the Federal Bureau of Investigations and the prosecutors, and it's just like level upon level of – and it's all – the entire cast are all stand-up comics, which is really – but they're all playing it straight. So it's a really, really good film.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's really great. It's called The Informant.
SGU movie night.
Yeah. But it's exactly what Steve's saying. It's like this comedy is way closer to how things actually work.
Yeah, totally.
Then he's like cutting edge, sharp shooting FBI people sneaking around and solving
the Matrix
or whatever.
Yeah.
Yep. A lot of illusions broken, you know, with reality here.
It always reminds me of Ed and Lorraine Warren. And this is why. Because we investigated Ed and Lorraine Warren. And they were this cranky old couple who had this didn't have the slightest clue, right? And then you watch the movies about them, and they're like these really serious, competent researchers. And the disconnect was massive.
So wait, who is this?
Massive.
Explain who this is. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know this.
Oh, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren. You live in New England. They're famous ghost hunters.
The Conjuring movie series.
Yeah, the Conjuring movie series.
Oh. Amityville Horror.
They got involved with that case. Yeah.
So we investigated them way back in the day, like before 97. The podcast. Yeah.
It was hilarious.
It was hilarious. Well, they're like these cranks, man. They're like the most ridiculous, unserious people you could imagine. And then you watch them portrayed in the movie.
Oh, my God.
And they're like giving these like serious academic looks at each other. You're like, oh, my God, that is so not them.
I watched The Conjuring and I was like, oh, my God, do we have to watch this? And it was I kind of enjoyed it. I liked the actors and they were not anything like the real people that I met.
Not even close.
Wow, so you guys met them and talked to them and everything?
Oh, yeah.
Interviewed them.
1 year investigation.
Wow.
We took their best evidence. We said, give us your best evidence. They gave us a videotape of a guy disappearing, and we ripped it apart. Ripped it apart. Like Evan took it to like his company at the time and
figured
and did
it
some
out
magic
in 5 seconds.
It.
Yeah, there's a guy standing in front of the screen. Someone hit pause. Basically, the guy walks out of frame and resumes the recording.
That was the extent of their evidence.
Voila!
That's called all TikTok videos, but okay.
And we proved it.
Really?
We proved it. They didn't even care.
Wow.
Nope.
Yeah.
That was the level
I don't
of
care.
Their sophistication.
I remember the quote, right, Steve? I don't care what you say. That guy disappeared.
That kid disappeared.
Quote unquote. Right.
Oh,
there.
So maybe they killed Jeffrey Epstein. That makes sense now.
Yeah.
With Iron Spheres.
But the best quote though in Perry loved this quote.
Say
was from Lorraine Warren.
Say it.
Yes.
What happened to you boys? Was it the science? Yeah,
she
Lorraine.
Said that to
it
you
was
guys?
The science. Yeah.
Yes. The science did it to us.
Science happened. Wow.
Yeah, that's what
was
did it.
Did you say, yeah, I guess. I guess that's what happened.
The science, as if it's a disease.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I always got a case of the science.
Do not understand what you are saying. Explain, please.
Like getting the vapors.
Bazinga.
I have the science.
All right, Bob. Is Betelgeuse finally going to blow? What's going on?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Mm. Yes, the star Betelgeuse is in the news again. Some researchers are now saying that they may have new evidence implying that it's bigger than we thought, which means that it could brighten our skies with a supernova, not in 100,000 years like all those other pesky scientists believe, but maybe a few decades, just a handful of decades.
Oh.
Amazing stuff here. So this newspaper is the paper is called The Evolutionary Stage of Betelgeuse Inferred from Its Pulsation Periods. Mm-hmm. First author, Hideyuki Sayao from the Astronomical Institute, Graduate School of Science at Tohoku University in Japan. And the paper is going to be published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomy Society. This was such a fascinating news item. So many interesting nooks and crannies, tangents all over the place. I loved researching this. First, let me get the pronunciation out of the way. It used to have weird, slightly different pronunciations. Betelgeuse, blah, blah, blah. But I think this is real. Tim Burton's movie, Betelgeuse, seems to really have had an impact, even among astronomers who say, yeah, I just say Betelgeuse now.
Why not?
And I think
as long as you say it three times, it's all good.
Yes.
Yeah. So Beetlejuice. So that's pretty, I think most people are saying that, and I think it just kind of like, that's it. It's Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice, the star in question is, it's a red supergiant star, hundreds of solar diameters, hundreds of light years away. The 10th brightest star in the night sky. That's, I didn't know it was in the top 10. Hmm. It's often thought of as the right shoulder of the constellation Orion, the hunter, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It has a very distinctive muted orange-red color, and that is probably the best way to dramatically show someone, if they need it, to show them that not all stars in the sky are just these white points of light. You look long and hard at Betelgeuse, you're like, damn, I see it. It's kind of orange reddish, which is kind of cool if you don't really look for it. So now those are some of the common facts. Some of the uncommon facts. Did you know that to many in Brazil, Betelgeuse is actually the hind leg of a caiman, which is a crocodilian. Mm. So they look up in the sky and they're looking for this hind leg of a caiman, or the foreleg of a turtle. In Japan, it's the rim of a ceremonial drum. And in Peru, this one's good. Peru, a Betelgeuse is one of the four vultures about to devour a criminal.
That's just silly.
Yeah, I like that one too. But most importantly, for this news item, Betelgeuse is it's a pulsating, semi-regular, variable star, which means it literally pulsates. It gets slightly bigger and smaller, decreasing and increasing its light output in a periodic but kind of irregular way. Its pulsations vary, and they've identified the cycles. It varies every 125 days, every 400 days, even every 2200 days. There are detectable cycles that they have documented. Now, this brightening and dimming seems to have gotten more dramatic in recent years, and whenever it happens, usually you're going to see lots of speculation online. People are saying, is it going to blow this time? Because we're just waiting. We know that this star is going to blow. It's a mature, it's an older supergiant star. We know this is going to happen. There's going to be a supernova. It's really just a matter of when. But things got even weirder right before the pandemic. Betelgeuse dimmed by an astonishing two-thirds. Two-thirds. That was huge. The dimmest that's ever been seen. It was so much so that they call it now the Great Dimming. They actually named the event the Great Dimming.
And it predicts it was, pandemics? Is that the takeaway?
Who knows? Yeah. Is there a connection? Of course not. It turns out that the star didn't really dim, though, like we thought. So you've heard of CMEs, coronal mass ejections.
Of course.
Our sun does it, you know, not infrequently. It just belches out a large ball of plasma wrapped in magnetism. And this is from its coronal outer atmosphere. But a CME, as bad as that is nothing, relatively speaking. We now think that the Great Dimming, I think Hubble and some other observatories detected that the Great Dimming was at least significantly caused not by a coronal mass ejection, but a surface mass ejection. Ever hear of that, Steve? Huh?
A surface mass ejection?
A surface mass ejection. This SME. Was so cool. And SME originates not from the star's tenuous outer atmosphere, the corona, but the photosphere, the very surface of the sun. Calculations put it, you know, when Betelgeuse did it, potentially 400 billion times the mass ejected compared to a typical solar CME.
Whoa.
400 billion times the mass. The thinking now is that the mass that Betelgeuse ejected, then that mass cooled and started blocking the light, causing the observed dimming. So it was this SME that caused the dimming and not really the star itself. Although the fact that the SME happened actually did cause some dimming, but the major dimming we saw was probably significantly contributed to by this surface mass ejection. Cool.
Hmm.
Never seen before. That's never been seen before in a normal star. Okay. So now let's get to the crux of the paper. What the hell are they saying and why? What the crux is, the contention of the researchers is that Betelgeuse is not merely a mature supergiant. It's really, really mature. Not like Bob and Steve mature, but like Bob and Steve's mom mature. That's the level of mature. I mean, it's like really end of life, kind of closer to end of life. Not that our mom's about to die, but she's 86.
Yeah, so you're going to go with that analogy.
Keep going, yeah. Hi, Mom.
I should have stopped at the joke part and, yeah, whatever. Okay, but so by that I mean, what does that even mean, Bob? By that I mean that the star has not only fused hydrogen into helium, which everybody agrees has happened, it's happening in our sun, But the researchers contend that it's already fused all of its helium into carbon as well.
Oh, here we go. The cycle's begun. Yeah.
And they go even a step further, which nobody has gone to before. They say, they contend that it's almost done fusing all of the carbon into heavier elements as well. And if that's truly the case, if they're right about that, then once carbon is gone, then it should only take a few decades. This is where the few decades is coming from. Once, if the carbon burning fusion is really almost done, then it's only a few decades to go through the remaining elements, of course, culminating in iron. Which, as we know, prevents further fusion, which lets gravity basically win that iconic battle between the gravity and the outward pressure from the fusion. That collapses a star, and then it partially rebounds, and bam, you've got the classic core collapse supernova. So that's what they think is happening, that this star is older than we think, and larger, actually.
Bob, how far away is it from us?
That's where, you know, we're not sure. We're not actually, and that's part of the problem. And I'll segue to that in just a paragraph here, because that's actually very important. It's a good question, George. So the question then becomes, well, why? Why do they think Betelgeuse is nearer to the end of its life than basically all the other researchers? They link it back to the Betelgeuse pulsations. It goes back to those cycles of dimming and brightening. That's why they think this. So unlike other scientists, they believe that the largest Betelgeusean, I wanted to say that word, the largest Betelgeusean pulsation period, that one that lasts 2,200 days, that is the most significant. It's the fundamental pulsation. And because that one, the 2,200 day, and not, for example, the 420 day one, the 2,200 day one, if that's the fundamental period that's happening, that the implication then that the star is larger because there's a direct link between that pulsation period and the diameter of the star. If that's the case, then that means the star is larger than we think, maybe 1,300 times the sun's radius. And that's not actually impossible. Thinking about it, you're like, well, wait a second. How do we not know? It was a little surprising to me, but it really isn't, because we're not sure how far away it is, because it could be merely very large and 540 light years away, or perhaps it's truly immense and 900 light years distant, right? So they can't really pin it down that close. It's difficult. In a lot of cases, it's very difficult to be that precise. And that, if that's correct, it's farther away and bigger than we think, then it's really a simple step to believe that the carbon burning is almost done. That would make it a much farther along in its life cycle than we think.
But so, Bob, I want it to go supernova now.
Now, well, hey,
I
man,
see it.
Well, got plans. And that's hosting a party.
And that segues nicely into my down to earth. Unfortunately, I still think Betelgeuse won't blow, probably for centuries, or even more likely millennia. Oh. I'm still there. Yeah. We'll see what peer review. It hasn't gone through peer review. It's not finished. We'll see what peer review says, and we'll also eventually see what maybe even further research reveals. But I want this to be so true so badly. One of the reasons is why? Because we've been ripped off in terms of seeing nearby supernovas.
Totally.
We, as a humanity, has been ripped off. It's really sad. Ugh. We should see, on average, one supernova in the Milky Way every century, and it's been
at least
419 years.
Oh,
400. Yeah. We are just like throwing snake eyes. It's really kind of sad.
Who do we submit our complaints to for this?
Yeah.
Well, the big culprit is probably all the nasty dust in the our galaxy that is obscuring some of these supernovas that have gone off at the far end of the galaxy, but have been so obscure that we didn't even see them. I think that's the theory now, that they have happened, but we just haven't seen them. But I still feel extremely ripped off.
Yeah.
The last one spotted was that in the Milky Way, naked eye, was Johannes Kepler in 1604. And get this, was 4 years before the invention of the telescope. How's that for a cosmic slap in the face? This amazing thing that's not going to happen for centuries. And, oh, here's a great invention, but it's not going to happen for 4 years.
It's almost as though the cosmos don't care about us, and that can't be true.
They don't. And that's so sad.
If Betelgeuse goes, though, if it goes nova, won't it sort of flash out the night sky for us for a significant amount of time?
Well, so the thinking now is that if it did go, it would be, first of all, it would be the astronomical event of the millennium.
Well, yeah.
It would be so gargantuan. Safety wouldn't be a concern since it's well past the 160 light years, which is the best estimate now that you need to be beyond before you can get kind of see some bad side effects of having a supernova go off.
But
it would be visible. They are predicting that it would be visible like the full moon even during the day. So,
right.
So a daylight supernova visible to the naked eye, that is that's
2 to 3 weeks.
That's it?
Just 2 to 3 weeks? I thought it was like for years.
No, 3 weeks.
It could be weeks or maybe even months, but yeah, typically.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, because I was all worried that, like, you know, if this goes off, that we won't have stars for like 5-10 years.
Oh, no, it wouldn't. Yeah. It wouldn't be that long. But yeah, that's interesting. That'd be a very bittersweet side effect, wouldn't it?
Right.
But still,
but
I want to see.
Work for that, right?
I want to see during the day, like, look at that. That is an exploding star. I'll end with this. Hopefully these researchers are correct and Betelgeuse already blew up centuries ago, right? And the light's almost here. Because remember, this is probably over 600 light years away. So it already happened, probably, maybe.
Maybe.
So that would be nice. It's already on its way here and we're just waiting for it to happen. Mm. I'm going to be, though, on the lookout for news that a pulse of neutrinos have been detected from the direction of Betelgeuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all know
the
first thing to escape from a supernova is not the photons or anything else.
No.
It's the neutrinos. Mm-hmm. They just go through it. So that's the first thing that we will see. When I read that in the news, I'm going to go out on my lawn chair and look in the direction of that hind leg of a caiman in the sky.
Yeah.
And I'm going to wait for the show. And that's what I'm going to do. But if that never happens, I have a backup plan.
Oh,
I may have to start saying over and over, Betelgeuse, Betelgeuse, Betelgeuse.
Yeah, that'll work.
And maybe it'll happen. You never know.
Neutrino, neutrino, neutrino.
I learned about neutrinos from 2012, that documentary.
Yeah, right, the documentary.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Bob. Andrea, this at first when you see this, and I've said this to a couple people, the reaction is the same. Like, can artificial intelligence solve math problems? You're like, what do you mean, like a calculator? Of course they can.
Yeah,
right.
But this is not about that, though.
Right. So this is about AI coming for mathematics. So the actual doing of mathematics as opposed to the arithmetic and calculations that most of us think of when we think of mathematics. And this was an article that was in the New York Times July 2nd. And, you know, I've been following, and I know I've talked on this show with all of you about, and I'm sure everyone listening has been listening to articles or reading about AI is coming for fill in the blank, right? Art, music, science, comedy, this and that. But the mathematics one gave me pause, and it gave me so much pause, in fact, that I like saw the push alert and I saw the headline and I thought, I actually can't face the possibility that mathematics could be something that AI comes for, even though, yes, sure, computers do math. But so I finally broke down and read the article. And then as we were approaching the show, I was like, I can't think of a group of people that I'd rather talk about this with. So I'm desperate to hear what you all think. But here's the gist of the article. The gist of the article is AI is coming for mathematics. What do we do about it? And the two things I thought were most interesting that I, above and beyond, you know, AI kind of encroaching into every field you can think of. So computers have been part of math and not just calculators, but part of doing math and problem solving and reasoning for a lot longer than I thought. And I'll say a little bit about some of the things I thought were most interesting there. And maybe you all already knew that. I didn't, apart from, you know, my TI-83, I didn't realize we were using math for things like proofs. And then the second piece that's interesting is that it poses questions about AI with respect to math and what it means to do mathematics. And that itself is sort of interesting as a non-mathematician, but someone who's had math envy is for as long as I can remember. It's always interesting to just hear mathematicians talk about what doing math is and how AI intersects with that. And then there's also some general questions about, you know, what are we doing when we're doing machine learning and computation by brute force versus reasoning, and everything around, you know, critical thinking, skeptical thinking seems to be the thing that computers still can't do. Question mark, can they ever get to a point where they can? And I feel like if computers can do mathematics, they can do everything else. So I don't know about you guys, but I did not realize that we have been using math to do things like validate and test our own reasoning and kind of pressure test proofs since earlier in the 1900s. And so we've been thinking about turning kind of the geometric propositions that we do when we do proofs and things like that into formulas that we can type into computers with our zeros and ones since the 1900s. And even as early as the 1960s, there was a proof assistant called Automath. Very creatively named. Automath.
I love it.
You're like, are you sure you weren't just saying calculator? But you're not. You're saying Automath. So the way that works is a mathematician would translate their proof into code, and then the computer would help check if their reasoning is correct. So think of it as like a spell check or like Clippy on Microsoft Word for your...
Yeah, Clippy.
Clippy. The lost art of Clippy is a tragedy that Gen Z will never appreciate. But
true.
But it will check if your reasoning is correct. And then eventually we built this body of verifications where we'd say, okay, this reasoning is right. And we used to have to do that with pen and paper. And again, that's not the same thing as, Steve, where you started this. We're saying, am I calculating this or solving for X? It's like, truly, is this logic right? And so by translating it to code, you can kind of get that. And in fact, do any of you know the first mathematical theorem that was proved with the help of a computational tool? Does anybody know what that is?
The first one? I don't.
No.
I'll give you a hint. It was proved in 1976. First mathematical theorem, first the major mathematical theorem.
Fermat's first theorem.
Fermat's first. Good guess, but no. The first major theorem proved with the help of computational, and this is brute force. We're just going through and saying, like, does this work? Was the four color theorem, four colors are enough to fill a map so that you have no two that are next to each other. So that was the first one that someone was like, I'm going to run this reasoning by Automath or by whatever version they were using, and they did it. Much more recently, you can check online now. It's a free online open source. You can download some software as well. A proof assistant system called Lean. So like Grammarly for mathematicians. And it uses what's called AI inspired logic, whatever that means. But basically, more brute force to do more verifying of theorems. And right now it's actively being used by mathematicians. And, you know, there's sort of purists who are saying we wouldn't use it, but it's really being used quite widely, much more widely than I was aware. So I'm in data science. We talk a lot about programming, but I had never come across Lean because you're really using this program, L-E-A-N, to verify your theorems. And so teachers that they interviewed in this article said, look, it's actually really helpful as a teaching tool. And this is interesting to me because I think about, as an educator, how we make sense of things like ChatGPT and teaching coding and all of that. And they said, look, the way this works is you basically explain your reasoning to a computer, and the computer can say whether or not that reasoning is correct. And most importantly, it's really bad at it. And so you have to be really, really, really specific. And there's a term that I loved that was in the article called proof whining. So apparently this Lean program is quite fussy, and it will whine and say, I don't understand your definition. I don't understand your reasoning. And so what it does, and maybe you all have experienced that with things like ChatGPT or generative AI and with language, where they kind of, because it's so dumb, you have to get simpler and simpler in your explanations of what it is that you are doing in your own logic. And there are arguments that both students and, you know, practicing mathematicians, high-level professors, come to the end of working with this thing by walking the computer through its own proof. And they say, wow, I actually understand my own proof better. And by the way, the computer helped be kind of a spell check on it. So that's
like
really
explain it to a 5-year-old kind of thing.
So the art of doing that has kind of become its own interesting way of learning and teaching math, which I had no idea any of that was going on. So this is all going on in the last 10 years. Not surprisingly, the last couple of years are the first time that mathematical societies are really seriously talking about AI, as are many, many of us in many fields. And really, one of the things that stood out to me is apparently in 2019, a researcher at Google said, I predict that we will have AI and computers that are as good, if not better, than the best mathematicians in the world within a decade. So 2019 prediction, so by 2029. Last year, that same researcher said, actually, we're going to do that by 2026. So it's like, that's how fast it's moving, that this guy is
updating. Usually doesn't go in that direction. Usually it's like, oh, I really meant 2035.
Right, yeah.
Usually it goes in the other direction.
Like when people ask me when I was going to finish my dissertation, and I said next year for 5 years, right? Like that's – whereas this, it's like, oh, we're ahead of schedule. It's the first time I've ever been upset that we're ahead of schedule because it's terrifying. So where does this leave us? Well, there's two questions that the article asked at the very end that I thought were really great, or they quoted a mathematician as asking, which is one question that we ask when we think about computers and we think about computation, we think about AI, is what can these machines do for us? And I think there's some interesting ideas here where basically you train, large language models, much like ChatGPT, on language from the general internet, but then you specialize it and you train it on mathematical and scientific papers. And it turns out they can really actually help you with this sort of iterative learning and validating as you go. But then there's the second question that I think is kind of the existential one. And I pose both of them to you all, which is what will these computers do to us? Right. You know, the thing that makes us scary, makes me scared is the computers that can write self-correcting code. And the computers that can kind of start to prompt it themselves with what to do. And the one area that kind of reassuringly for my Luddite brain, at least, that computers seem to be completely unable to do with respect to mathematics is exactly what you would think and is exactly what the barrier is in data science, social science. Steve, I'm sure in medicine, this is it, which is this reasoning. Basically, computers can just brute force their way through things. They can detect patterns. They can tell you where to look. Kind of the most sophisticated ones can help you say, I think there's a solution in this problem space, but I can't find it. The computer could either say, yes, there's a solution, or they might even tell you what that solution is, but you can't understand why that's the solution or how you'd get there. So it's sort of, Steve, like having an Alzheimer's disease that helps, but you don't know why it's helping. And in a lot of domains, you'd say, well, who cares? It's helping. That's good enough. But in mathematics, and this gets to the point of like, what does it even mean to do mathematics? Many mathematicians are saying, well, the whole point of mathematics is the reasoning, and it's getting from A to B. It's not the finding B that's so interesting. It's the process by which we get there. And that seems to be the area that computers are not even close to getting to. And so that gives me, as someone who's afraid of the future, a little bit of solace. But we're evolving so fast that maybe that's not going to be the case. And we're going to see computers start to reason. So I really, you know, maybe you all have talked about this at length, but what better group to talk about the future of computers doing critical thinking than a group of critical thinkers? So I don't know where you all are in terms of your thinking around this kind of stuff.
Maybe that'll be the linchpin that sort of, that just does drive the reasoning engine. It'll be, you know, you would think it would be some kind of problem solving on a macro level, but maybe getting into the nitty gritty of basic mathematical reasoning will be the breakthrough thing that then will be like the killer app on some level.
Exactly. You know, we've seen computers get to points. Again, it's all through brute force so far where we get to like, we can beat people in chess. We can beat people in Go. We can do this generative language model that's like very eerie sometimes. But at the end of the day, we still need to set the parameters for the computer and tell the computer what to do. And it really cannot logic itself through. And that kind of the, you know, in a purist sense, the mathematician, you know, writes proofs. And so, you know, just like we've talked on this show as well about, you know, is the point of painting the output of a nice thing to look at or the art of doing the painting? And so mathematicians are saying, well, I still do the proofing, and that's the math. Proofing is not the right word there. But who cares in a way, right? If you can use this to brute force your way into various solutions that we can apply, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a microcosm of everything we're dealing with AI right now, in that it, you know, what we're learning is, you know, how powerful the new AI apps are, but also how dumb and brittle they are at the same time, like what they can and cannot do. I do think they do reason to some extent in their own sort of way, just not the way humans reason. But it is limited, and it does use a lot of, well, feed me billions of data points and I'll go through it over and over, you know, a billion times, and that's how I'll get to my answer, which is just not what people are good at, right? It's what powerful supercomputers are good at, but not people. So it's getting to the result in just in a different way. So, you know, again, just if you just play around with any of the generative AI software, you realize that, wow, it's really good at mimicking stuff. It's really bad at understanding what I want it to do. You know, it doesn't have like the basic reasoning that a person would have. And it forces you to learn how to speak its language because it's so quirky. So that's fascinating. But I do think, yeah, it sounds like the strength, I'm not surprised. It's like, it's really, from what I hear, like everyone, every expert who talks about like how AI in their field, like, yeah, it's not thinking for you, but like it's really good at debugging your software, or it's really good at checking your proof, or it's good at offering suggestions about possible diagnoses, but it's not going to manage your patient for you. But it's a good tool. It's a really, really good tool. And I do think, for multiple reasons, that it's not going to make people stupid. It's going to make people smarter.
That's my hope.
That's always the way this tends to work out, is that it may free us from some drudgery. And so we might think, you might say like, oh, people don't know how to do, addition in their head anymore. Yeah, but we traded that for being able to think at a much deeper level, because we're kind of freed up from this drudgery. Yeah. In a way.
Well, there's a great analogy by David Krakauer, who's the president of the Santa Fe Institute, where he, on some other podcast, talked about, like, you want technology that's kind of like a bicycle, right? We're walking, and then we come up with some way to, like, move faster, as opposed to something like, we can debate this particular example that he gave, something like Google Maps, where you just stare at your phone and don't actually learn where anything is, and you're overly reliant on this thing, and you're not actually doing the thinking or the spatial reasoning. He postulated that as one that's maybe making us dumber. But even that, you could say, I don't have to map my route so I can focus on something else. So great.
Yeah. But the bottom line is, people are getting smarter.
Yeah. Yeah.
As much as we want to feel like, the idiocracy is real.
Right.
That if you just in terms of just intelligence, like standardized IQ tests, there's a steady increase in IQ tests.
It brings up the question of, what does it mean to be smarter, right? And for a long time, it meant knowing facts, which once we had the internet, that goes away. And I have been saying to my students forever, I was like, learn how to code because it's a helpful tool, but it's like, you don't need to memorize it. What you need to really work on is the critical thinking and all of that, because you need to know what to write in code. That's the harder part. And we basically now have ChatGPT that can write the code for you. You have to be able to read it. You have to know what it says and what it's doing and whether it works, and debug it, or to an extent. But we still need the ideas.
You have to code it in such a way verbally that it knows what you mean and produces what you're asking for. So that, I think, people in the future will become increasingly important if they can interface with some sort of, like, ChatGPT analog and get the results better than other people can.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be, it'll be a tool, an amazing tool for a period of time, and then more of a partnership for a period of time. And then after that, I think we're just going to be outclassed in so many,
We'll just merge with the AI.
That's possible. Oh, okay. And that's always like the hope that something like that could happen. But also, Andrew, you mentioned, this brute, brute force.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we've gone beyond brute force. And the best example I could think is AI chess games.
Yeah.
The early games were absolutely brute force, going through thousands, millions of different moves, looking as deep in the future as possible. But the latest iterations, the last one I'm familiar with, at AlphaZero, they didn't actually give it anything other than, here are the rules of chess. And it played against itself billions of times and became, the best chess player, better than any human could ever really hope to be on their own. And so that's kind of beyond this idea of brute force. It became a way to think about chess that was kind of foreign to the way people do. And we'll never be able to beat it with, an unaugmented human will never be able to beat that. I love this idea, looking at some of this research on math, though. This idea, what's his name? Marjan Hewell from Carnegie Mellon. He refers to it as brute reasoning, which I love.
Yes.
Brute reasoning. What a fantastic way to describe this.
Yes.
It's like, and that's something that's going to just become more prevalent, more effective, more efficient. And it's going to be, they'll be able to reason far beyond. I mean, there are some things that people but we'll never be able to do because of the limitations of our biological brain. The smartest dog in the world, I say it over and over, the smartest dog in the world will never learn algebra, no matter how smart the dog is.
Yeah.
It just will be forever beyond it. So what is forever beyond humanity in terms of being able to conceptualize ideas and figure and solve problems? There's problems out there, I'm sure, that we just can't do. And we will need not only the help of some types of AI, but only AI will really be able to ever really.
I'm good as long as they don't destroy us.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a pole and pole vaulting, right? If you could really harness it, or use it properly. Yeah, and the brute reasoning, I love that word too. And basically the idea is, yeah, you describe what you're trying to find and the computer will find it. By the way, in this article, they referenced a paper that was just finalized. I don't think it's been published, but they just kind of finished the proof. It's the largest proof that's been, you know, computationally assisted, and it was 50 terabytes to make it happen.
That's insane.
Terabytes.
Yeah, so it's Ooh, it's
Steve,
so
you don't even have that much storage.
That's but nuts.
They're also about, you know, when they compared, you know, this isn't quite the same thing as IQ tests, but when they give some of these programs math tests, apparently many of them work out to be about a little bit better than an average 16-year-old American on high school math exams. So they're not that far behind.
But
there's a lot of there's a lot of brute force behind it. But you know, all you need to do is set aside what we're doing with the AI and a lot of it, what you're describing with chess around like neural nets and the predictions that they're making with that are amazing, much more flexible, inspired by how humans think. But the scary thing, you know, I think Evan, you just said it is, you know, we don't know how it gets to these predictions. And as long as they are subservient to us, it kind of doesn't matter.
Right. Are they going to see us as a pest in the way of their work?
Right, say, right, yeah.
Get out of my way, son.
Are they going to team up with the bears? You know, who knows?
Totally.
Yeah.
So just to get back to one thing you said, Andrea, in terms of like the effect on people, over like the last 20, 25 years of medical education, what I've seen is we've gone from like a real emphasis on didactics and factual information to like not even worrying about teaching facts and just teaching students how to think. Mm-hmm. Like we don't even lecture anymore. And in terms of like teaching students, like we don't ask them factual questions because the assumption is you will have all the, obviously you need to have a fund of knowledge, right? You can't think in a vacuum, but like being able to just memorize a bunch of facts is not important because you can get access to those, that information when you need it. The important thing is how to evaluate information and how to think clinically. Mm-hmm. And so medical school education, you know, at least at my institution, has really completely changed in 20 years and has been, now it's all workshops. You know, we don't even lecture students anymore.
Wow.
That's crazy, man. Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like all tests should be open book, basically. Like,
yeah, basically.
On every level, they should just basically be applied open book, you know, quote unquote book, but open information tests of just, how do you solve this problem?
I mean, even in my course, you know, intro data science, I would love to be able to give an exam that's like, here's some data, like, have a go, you know, or like, here's what we're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Steve, that's very encouraging because even, you know, 10 years ago, I was in grad school and I had a number of friends who were medical students and I feel like they were just memorizing charts and drawings of arms and stuff.
You've got to know stuff. You got to learn information. But, you know, at least when you get to the clinical years, like the third year, like, I don't care if you know factoids. I want you to tell me how to think your way through a problem. You know? All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. So we just have three regular news items this week. There's no theme or anything. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right, here they go. Item number one, a new paper estimating the number of planets in the Milky Way with liquid water increases the estimate by 100-fold from prior estimates, up to one planet per system on average. Item number two, a new bionic arm for an above-the-elbow amputation allows the user to control individually each finger of the hand using only connections with the remaining muscles. And item number three, in an example of convergent evolution, new DNA analysis finds that the pygmy right whale is actually a porpoise.
Oh.
Andrea, you made a noise. That means you
get
to go
first.
Yeah,
my world is turned upside down if that third one is true.
All right, Andrea, please go first.
Thank you. This is interesting. So I think the one about the bionic arm for an above-the-elbow amputation is the fiction. Because I think I'm miffed by the connection between, oh, okay, when you were describing, I was like, we're going to allow the user to control each finger of the hand using only connections with the remaining muscles. I was expecting you to say something, you control each finger of the hand using signals from your brain, as opposed to something with the actual muscular connections. And I just, I feel like there's something missing in there, where it's like, there's got to be some nerves that are connected, or there's got to be some implant in your brain. I'm not moved by the idea that we just have wires tied to muscles. I'm sure there's more to it, but for some reason that one I was like, nah, that's not what's going on. Like, we're either missing something big and oversimplifying, or it's so basic we already have it. So for one of those reasons, I think that one's the fiction.
Okay, George?
You know, I have to say, Andrea, that, like, that's exactly what I thought, which now makes me question whether I should.
You're like, if Andrea thought it, it can't be.
No, like, correct. spot on. I'm thinking, like, yeah, it's not the actual flesh muscle input. It's probably a brain thing. And Steve's being all clever Stevie, where he's going to be able to say, like, no, it's actually the neuron of the thing of the thing. And then you go, ah. So I'm going to agree that the bionic arm is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The non-bionic arm ones. Yeah, they seem reasonable. The bionic arm does not seem reasonable, and I'll add a little bit more flesh to my answer than you guys.
A little more
the
meat?
Problem, as I see it,
George.
The problem as I see it is this. Your fingers, there's no muscles in your hand. There's all tendons that connect to the muscles in your forearm. That's the problem. The premise here is that the forearm is gone. The muscles are gone. I don't know how the hell you're going to control five fingers without the muscles from your forearm, because that's what controls it. So I don't know what kind of weird flexing you're going to do with your bicep or deltoid to actually move five different fingers. I think that's the Achilles heel, if you will, of this one. So I'll say that's good.
Bob, as you described that, I'm literally sitting here looking at my arm like trying to move just my bicep. It's like not working.
I'm doing the Luke Skywalker right here, right now, too.
Am I doing science? Yeah.
Move your fingers and look at your forearm. It's all in the forearm.
Okay, and Devin.
Oh, boy. Wow, not even a comment about the number of planets in the Milky Way,
you know,
with liquid water? Not even a comment.
That's just like, doesn't surprise me, because we're always learning, oh, there's a greater chance for life. And then, oh, wait, there's less chance. Oh, now there's a greater chance. It's all back and forth, back and forth. So
I suppose you're right. He does write it here, a new paper estimating the number of planets. So it's only an estimate.
It is dramatic, I'll give you that. But this forearm muscle one really grabbed me.
And why didn't we go with the whale? Is it actually a porpoise one? A new DNA analysis finds that the pygmy right whale, that's a thing, pygmy right whale is actually a porpoise.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I wonder how big they
are. And above the elbow amputation, what am I going with everyone else? Am I being that
predictable? Nah, be bold, strike out.
One of us.
Be the fringe skeptic today.
All right, fringe skeptic. Pygmy right whale, actually a porpoise, fiction.
Okay. So you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there.
Dove in without a life jacket.
We bullied you into it.
Totally.
Just caved to peer pressure.
Everyone's doing it.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll start with number one, since you all agree on that one. A new paper estimating the number of planets in the Milky Way with liquid water increases the estimate by 100-fold from prior estimates, up to one planet per system on average.
Uh-oh,
you guys all think this one is science.
Please be science.
Order of magnitude.
I really want it to be science, personally.
Science. This is science. So what do you think is different?
H2O.
What do you think is different about this new estimate? What did they do differently that increased their estimate by 100-fold?
The information from the exoplanets?
The types of stars that could host planets?
That was part of it. That was part of it, but that's not the key difference.
Changed whatever they're doing to detect liquid water.
Nope. More Goldilocks zone.
Larger number of planets?
I know. They redefined water.
Well, sort of, Bob. They redefined planet with water in that way.
Well, subsurface?
Yes, subsurface.
That's it.
So if you include planets that are frozen on the surface but have subsurface water, subsurface liquid water, then that dramatically increases it.
Because it makes sense.
Partly because it also includes a lot more planets
outside the Goldilocks.
Yeah, yeah, outside the traditional Goldilocks zone, but also a lot of planets around red dwarfs, which we know is like most of the stars out there.
Mm. Yeah, that's huge. Yeah.
Cool.
And they say that there's, you know, so for these, so we're used to thinking of moons with frozen surfaces and liquid water because of the tidal forces keep the water liquid. So what keeps the water liquid on planets?
Well, radiation.
Radioactivity, absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
Radioactive decay heats up the interior, causes the water to be warm enough to be liquid, and that's a sort of an alternate scenario. And once you add that to your estimates, like there could be tons of planets, you know, 100 times as many planets.
Wow.
With liquid water,
that's awesome.
Not on the surface.
That's very cool.
Yeah, very cool. All right.
Surprised they didn't include that.
Filled
earlier.
With porpoises, I assume.
I guess we'll go. We'll take these
about
in water.
To be destroyed by Betelgeuse as well. So yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. We'll go to number two. A new bionic arm for an above the elbow amputation allows the user to control individually each finger of the hand using only connections with the remaining muscles. Evan, you think this one is science? The rest of you don't buy it. You think it's fiction. So Evan, how do you think this works?
So let's see. So above the elbow, huh? Using only the connections with remaining muscles. They take the remaining muscles and they stretch them way, 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 way out along the bionic substructure of the.
Arm hurts just thinking about it.
Yeah, but probably not.
No, they don't do that. I'll say that. But you're on the right track in that. Ooh. They do some kind of surgery to alter the muscles. So this one is science, guys.
Holy moly.
Oh, Jesus. Oh,
no way.
I thought for sure the porpoise was a false.
Stupid whales.
we'll get to that one in a minute.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is just a really good advance in bionic technology.
No way.
What they do, so this is something that we've been covering on this show, you know, over the years, you know, every little incremental kind of advance. If you recall some of those specific ones, you could make sense of it a little bit better. So there's different ways you can get the person, the body, to communicate to the prosthesis, right, the robotic limb. One is with brain signals, right? That's, one way, whether it's directly or indirectly or wirelessly, whatever. Another one is with nerves. Mm-hmm. But the other way is with muscles. And the advantage there is that the electric current generated by a muscle contraction is like an order of magnitude bigger than what you're going to get from the nerve itself. And so a small patch of muscle can create a big signal. Then, so that if you're recording from the muscle, it's a lot easier to control so you're not using the muscle to move the robotic hand, you're using the muscle to communicate to the robotic hand.
Right.
And so, you hit upon a really interesting thing. How do they get these proximal muscles above the elbow to control 5 digits on a robotic hand? So what they did was they took the nerves and they separated them along the fascicle line. So basically, like a bundle of nerves has like different subnerves within it, right? Different fascicles. And so they dissected them away. So you turn one nerve into like 5 nerves. And then you connect that to different patches of muscle. And then you connect those muscles to different connections on the bionic arm. And there you go. And then the person learns how to control the fingers with these different subnerves and submuscles in their arm. In like
their upper arm. What are they flexing? What are they trying to flex?
Here's the other thing. Another piece to the puzzle. They use AI to interpret the signals.
Oh, I was just about to say.
Here we go.
AI can't figure this out.
So here we go. All they have to do is just figure out how to do 5 different things, right?
Yeah,
they'll learn to communicate back and forth. This is a tour de force. This is a real like more than just an incremental advance. This is like a significant advance. They also have sensory feedback from this limb too, which we've talked about also. So these are all components we've talked about on the show in the past.
All coming together.
But the real additional thing is just the engineering is off the hook, and just the surgical techniques have significantly advanced, separating out the nerves to increase the amount of control that you get.
Cyberpunk, baby. Cyberpunk.
Yeah. Don't go cutting off your arm to replace it. Yeah, with it.
Like when I was reading it, and like, where's the arm connected? And then you show the picture of the guy. It's like, oh, this is an above the elbow amputation. It's connected to his proximal muscles. you know, it's amazing.
Upgrade me. Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, which means that in an example of convergent evolution, new DNA analysis finds that the pygmy right whale is actually a porpoise. Is the fiction...
Clearly.
Boring.
This now, it's a little bit more interesting when you know a little bit something about whale evolution. So there are, basically, if you take the group that whales are in, the cetaceans, right? They are divided into two big groups. Do you guys know what those are?
The large cetaceans.
The baleen whales and the other ones?
The baleen whales and all the other ones, which are the
blowhole.
If you don't have baleen, what do you have?
Teeth.
Teeth. So it's the baleen whales and the toothed whales, right? That's the first dividing part.
I have a science teacher somewhere who's sort of proud that I was able to muster baleen.
Now, the toothed whales as a group include dolphins, porpoises, and then all the other whales with teeth, like sperm whales, right? So the right whale is a baleen whale, and the pygmy right whale, also a baleen whale, called the pygmy right whale because they both look very similar. They essentially feed by skimming the surface of the water, as opposed to like taking a big gulp of water and then straining. Yeah, they're skimming and straining the surface. So their like baleen anatomy looks very similar. So there is some convergent evolution. There is some convergent evolution going on there. But what they did is they did a DNA analysis of the pygmy right whale, and they found that it's not a right whale at all.
Wow.
It's on its own branch. It's like it's the last example of a very ancient whale line. But it's actually over with another group of whales. So not the right whales. It's with the Rorquals, Rorquals.
Gee
whiz. It's like on that point.
You made that up.
No.
It sounds like narwhal.
Yeah. So
welcome to Fantasy Whale.
Now, but moving it all the way over to a toothed whale would be insane because it's a baleen whale, right? So that was why that had to be the fiction. But I was just basing it on this story where, we rejiggered the evolutionary family tree of these whales moving over. The pygmy right whales are really not right whales. They're their own branch of whales.
Wow.
That go back 16 to 20 million, to 19 or so million years ago. Yeah, but they're not toothed whales.
Still delicious,
very
though.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right.
My reasoning totally was like, Steve wouldn't put something with the word porpoise in it and have that be fiction because porpoise is a funny word. Like, this is where my brain is.
I actually thought, should I use porpoise or dolphin?
Yeah.
And I specifically chose porpoise because I thought it would be more plausible.
You did it on purpoise.
Yeah, I did it on porpoise.
I was right there.
I should have. Yeah.
So what did we learn? Peer pressure is a good thing.
Yeah, Evan, you're welcome.
And Evan, good on you for striking out on your own. I like it when people are rewarded for breaking from the crowd. Very good.
It is scary. Thanks, Bob.
All right, Evan, and as a reward, you get to give us a quote.
Woohoo! Every time you perform a magic trick, you're engaging in experimental psychology. If the audience asks, how the hell did he do that? Then the experiment was successful. That was by Raymond Teller, also known as Teller.
Teller. Yeah.
Penn and Teller.
Yeah, Penn and Teller are examples of magicians who, like, this is how we do this. This is a trick. This is what's happening here. But they still fool you some other way. And they had this bit where they literally walk you through the trick that they're doing. It's still entertaining as hell.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Because of just the way they do it and the skill with which they do it. But then, you have to do something that you didn't explain to the audience. To still wow them. But, and the other, like, the best mentalist I've ever personally seen was Banachek, who is amazing.
Amazing.
And again, he is like, this is a trick. It's not, however you think I'm doing it, that's not how I'm doing it. It's a complete trick.
Yeah.
And then he just still blows you away, just utterly blows you away. And the mentalists that I've seen who are like, I'm really psychic, like the amazing Kreskin, are terrible. They're not good at all. And I do think that's not a coincidence. I think that they're, using the I'm really magic thing to cover up for the fact that they're just not that good.
And it totally conflates, kind of going back to what we talked about before, like where wonder comes from. Like the wonder in the cases of the really good mentalists or performers is, gosh, how did they do that? And then figuring it out or thinking about it and guessing. Like that's, you know, like Evan was saying, like, that's the experiment and the fun that we get to do as audience members. And the wonder of, like, I guess he's a wizard. Like, that's not wonder. Yeah. That's that's blind faith in an unproductive way.
It's too simple. Yeah. It's just, oh, it's actual magic. No, there's, like, it's way more, it's way cooler than that. It's way cooler than magic. It's thought and construction and, and skill and,
it's something that you could achieve on your own.
There's that too, right?
But it's it's appreciating the skill to be able to do that. There's an account, I'm very pleased that Instagram mostly gives me garbage, but it started serving me up magic accounts on on Instagram Reels. And so now I follow someone called Ecat Magic, I think. And she basically just explains how you do various sleight of hand and so on. And it's so much more interesting to learn how it's done than to just watch someone make a quarter disappear.
It's a beautiful art form.
It's incredible. Really,
that's why Batman is the best superhero, because we can all be Batman. There's no superpowers.
You know? His superpower is that he's rich. But that's
George,
you have to have a
Venmo
portion.
Me quick.
Theoretically, you know, you cannot be a son of Krypton. You cannot be bitten by a radioactive spider. You cannot have
yourself. But
what you do on the weekends is up to you. But you know, this idea, like, oh, you if you train yourself and have enough resources and whatever, you can become Batman. It's the same thing. You could be Banachek. You know, you could be. I mean, the guy is he did an hour show at SciCon 2 years ago. It was unreal. It was amazing. Like, even being backstage watching him do it, it's still like, how is this possible?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he spent his whole life perfecting his craft, and now he has his own show on Las Vegas. Well,
but
deserved.
Like, but it's
and
so
he earned it. He earned
so
it.
Much cooler that that it's like
watching a ballerina or a gymnast do an incredible thing. You're like, I don't know how they're doing that many flips in the air. Like, it's a similar kind of
right.
Musician,
imagine if some gymnast came along and said, you know, I am achieving these flips in the air that you can't do, that most people can't do. I'm achieving it through, you know, I am keying into Zeus's power.
Yeah. Gravity doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, gravity doesn't apply. I have a medallion from Zeus. You'd be like,
yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, that's awful. And then like, and if you touch my medallion, then you'll have good luck or whatever, you know.
Right. Don't forget to buy my merch.
Right.
They indulge in people's fantasies. Real magicians appeal to people's sense of wonder. Different thing.
I love David Copperfield's explanation of magic. Like, the magic is in, nobody would ever imagine that you spent as much time and energy as you did figuring out something so stupid. You know, like, figuring this one stupid little thing out, and because it's the magic is in the hours and hours and hours and hours of just figuring out how to do that little thing that will trick people, you know?
But why is it there are thousands of other examples of people using unbelievable skill to achieve things that never get brought into the category? Like, you don't look at a carpenter who's like this amazing skilled carpenter who puts together a sculptor or a car mechanic or an airline pilot or that's doing these unbelievable pseudo superhuman things because they've put in their 30,000 podcasters. Exactly.
Incredible podcast.
You know, the person that develops the bionic arm on some level, it's like, my gosh, the teamwork involved and the brain power involved to make that happen. No one's going to say, oh yeah, it's magic. They're using magic to make bionic arms. Like, why does it get a pass? Why does that entertainment get a pass? Because it has this history of being connected with mysticism and whatever.
I love watching how-to and instructional videos on YouTube. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Of course.
Is for experts to show me how things, you know, how they figured things out, how things work together, how they are, how they accelerated at their craft. It's fascinating. I could watch that forever.
But if a car mechanic said, I can fix your carburetor because the rules of oxygenation don't apply to me, you'd think they're bananas. And you'd be like, get the hell out of here.
They were daft.
Crazy. It's crazy.
All right. Well, guys, thank you for joining me, George, Andrea.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Now we have to mention that the both of you are going to be with the SGU at Nauticon in November, November 2nd and 3rd in White Plains. Check out the Skeptic's Guide website for all the information. This is going to be a physical, in-person, actual meetup. not virtual. It's going to be a, George, what kind of crazy crap are you throwing at us during that?
Oh, we've got some musical things happening. We've got some like super. Think of the most brilliant question you've always wanted to ask the SGU, and you'll get a chance to do it in person with them in the room with you. Like that, there might be some maybe like a game or two, or a scavenger hunt, or maybe some kind of a. This is going to be. It's like so much. Mm-hmm. But it's also not going to be like any conference you've ever been to. That's the best part of it, because it's not a con. It's not a conference. It's not a con is what it is.
Yeah. And Andrew, you're going to do some kind of circus act.
We're looking into whether the venue wants me to do some circus acts, but permission and or willingness to beg forgiveness after the fact, provided I will be, I got a room of things right here behind me, and I'm only doing it because I'm gifted by God and I don't obey the laws of fire. So that's why I'll be doing it.
The laws of combustion don't apply to you.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, I'm
really looking forward to it.
It'll be fun.
All right. Again, thank you for joining me this week, guys.
Thanks.
Sure, man. Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.